Welcome to Global Math Department. My name is Paula Torres, and I will be your host tonight. Tonight, we're going to hear from Jason Slobey about how things that are thrown at us stick. So before we get started, I would love for everyone to introduce themselves in the chat window. I see a couple people have started to chime in. Tell us what you teach, where, and what your Twitter handle is if you have one. Well, hello, Lydia Kirkman. I haven't seen you in ages. Ooh, and what time, Andrea, is it in Malaysia right now?
I was wondering the same thing.
You're either burning the midnight oil or you're up super early.
Very cool.
So please continue to introduce yourselves. I'm going to explain a little bit about how Global Math Department works. We are here almost every single Tuesday at the same time. And we pride ourselves on offering a really friendly and supportive chat room for people to participate in while they're hearing a great webinar for the evening about something pertaining to math. I will catch your questions so Jason doesn't have to stop and read all of your questions. He will probably stop at some point and kind of peruse through them because I know he's going to ask you some questions. But don't worry, it is my job to pay attention to the questions. So if they don't get answered, I'll make sure that I chime in at the end. Again, the meeting is recorded. So if you have to cut out early or a colleague of yours really needs to hear about this, which they probably do, know that they can come back a couple of hours after the meeting ends because it is recorded. And you can use the same URL that you used to get in here tonight. So I do want to introduce Jason Slobey. He teaches high school math in Temecula, California, where it is really warm today. His interests include GeoGebra, Excel, coding, and investing, and any way he can weave those into sometimes our otherwise mundane math curriculum. He's developed a passion for leadership, and he's eager to connect with others who share his passion and aspire to such roles. And as I stated earlier, tonight he's going to present to us about how we get resources, best practices, and other PD thrown at us. And often it doesn't stick, but he's hoping that some of what he shares tonight will actually stick with us. And I know I, for one, am looking very forward to this. So without further ado, Jason, take it away.
Great. Thank you so much. Good evening, everyone, and thank you for spending your evening with me tonight. I'd like to get straight into it. So on the title slide, you see the website, slobey.weebly.com. I have a presentation page where all the slides, all the links, all the articles I reference, everything is there. So don't feel like you have to screenshot or copy down links. Everything is there. And then I'd also encourage you to participate vibrantly in our conversation tonight. Even as I'm presenting, I'd like you to chat in the chat window. And then, as Paula said, I'll be checking that. There's four segments in the presentation tonight. So after each of the four segments, and then we can have a nice chat and see what conversation is happening there. And I can comment and answer questions at those times. So the first part, I'd like you to, we'll test out the polls here. So if you would head over to the chat window, and I'm going to post this poll. There we go. And so the question I'd like you to answer is, how funny is this math comic? Hint, there's only one correct answer to this question. All right, great. Looks like it's working for everybody. Great. So later in the presentation, I'll be asking you a few other poll questions, and I'll have you respond the same way. And then secondly, I mentioned in the chat window, so I'll share another joke with you verbally, and you can comment in the chat window specifically about how amazingly hilarious you think this joke is. This Fibonacci joke is as bad as the last two you heard combined. This Fibonacci joke is as bad as the last two you heard combined. Amazing. Love it. All right. So yes, we are working there too. As I do this just so you are now capable, you know how this all works. Have the comments going in the chat. And as I mentioned earlier, I'll be checking that throughout the presentation. All right, with that, let's get into it. All right, so I'll share first a little bit of my experience through attending and planning conferences, various forms of professional development online at conferences, site-based, district-based, through online communities like many of us here. We've all seen, I think, many good ideas, but in my own reflection, surprisingly few have made their way back into my classroom, even despite my best intentions for that to happen. And over the years, I've come to think that that's almost inevitable. It's not okay, but it's kind of okay. Because considering new ideas, just being active in the process of hearing new ideas and debating and thinking about them, even if I don't retain many of them, that still does help me to open my mind, to think differently about other issues, nudge me toward contrarian ways of thinking, which I've come to appreciate more over time. And for me, overall, it's less about the specific activity sheets or the specific lesson plans or the different real life applications, for example. And it's more about the mindsets. It's the big picture ideas for me that apply across many lessons. And so this led me to wonder what makes some of these ideas stickier than other ideas. Why is it that I retain some ideas and not others? So for me, informally, I came up with these three attributes of sticky ideas. The first being if it's the idea is told through a story or a metaphor, it's easy to remember that. If that learning connects known dots for me, something I know in unknown ways, or third, that it dovetails with prior experiences in some insightful and maybe surprising ways. There's a bunch of other literature and research about this. There's several great books about making it stick, for example. But these are just kind of informally how I've thought about that issue. So just in short, it's been the big ideas. It's been the best practices across many lessons as opposed to individual lesson resources. And so that was my motivation for the presentation tonight. But I'd imagine, of course, that we've all had similar experiences maybe with professional development. We've all heard countless ideas, but only have a few of them make it back maybe into our own classrooms. And one of the downsides then of some of this professional development, however much there is, it's almost like a deluge, I think, of information. Everyone's trying to contribute their great ideas, and we're passionate, we're excited about it. And it just creates a gushing overflow of these ideas that it's kind of hard to deal with sometimes. Even on Twitter, which we all love, I think has the same problem. There's just so much out there. Sifting through it is very time consuming. And so although there are increasing numbers of good ideas out there, it's also increasingly difficult to find the ones that are most likely to stick to us in our own practice. So in other words, I think there's plenty of stuff being thrown at our walls, our metaphorical walls, and figuring out the smaller subset of those ideas of what will stick to each of our walls has become of great interest to me. And so in a sense, I feel like this needs to change. So maybe the whole point of professional development is to throw stuff at the wall and see what sticks. It certainly is true from my own experiences with professional development. In some ways, complicating, I think, this volume of ideas out there problem is the human side of teaching and learning. If you're familiar with Better Lesson, I did some work with them a few years ago with their Master Teacher Project. They have this ambitious tagline, share what works. In my own experience, I think sharing what works and kind of the plan of hear great lessons and take advantage, in some ways, it overstates, I think, what's maybe possible. And it maybe underestimates the reality that classroom teachers work within. For example, anyone who spent hours writing ambitious subplans, because we're going to be out the next day, we come back and we find that only very little of what we had actually hoped for was actually accomplished. We know that these lesson plans and resources by themselves are just not transferable. We can't just write a great lesson plan and expect it to be followed in any reasonable or sensible form. I think far more important, though, is the teacher's skill and aptitude in leading discussions, in enacting those tasks and facilitating a meaningful discourse, reflecting after the lesson on ways to improve. I think these are the tangibles that really what makes things work, and ultimately for me, what makes things stick. Even this is hard, of course. I believe it was the TIMSS study. You found that American teachers tend to start with really good tasks anyway. Sometimes we think, you know, finding good tasks is the problem. They found a lot of American teachers started with really good tasks, but the teachers amputated their effectiveness by too quickly trying to wrap up the task or moving students too quickly through it before the students were ready to make those connections themselves. And so yet again, we come back to giving teachers good tasks or sharing resources online is insufficient. We still need to be adept with the implementation side of teaching as well. Phil Darrow tells a story about the difference between Japan and US schools. The quick quote here is, lessons should be slow and sticky, not quick and snappy. You can probably guess which of those phrases describes Japanese schools versus the US schools. Phil Darrow tells a story about how he's talking with the Japanese Minister of Education about why they are so successful with what they do. And the Japanese minister responded by saying something to the effect of, I'm paraphrasing here, but you move on too quickly in the United States. We don't. And that has really stuck with me over the years. Phil Darrow also goes on to describe a typical Japanese lesson, what it might look like. And he says, basically, the teacher would pose a problem. Answers would start flowing from the students. The teacher maybe spends 10 to 15 more minutes after the students have posed those answers in these Japanese classrooms. The teachers don't just go on. They spend 10 to 15 more minutes after those answers to delve into the underlying mathematics, to look at variations on the problem, to analyze mistakes and different routes that students took gaining entry and proceeding through the problem. All the deeper learning that we know makes rich and meaningful mathematics, but only after that 10 to 15 minutes are they thinking about maybe the next problem. They might do two or three problems in a single lesson. They found, of course, in the United States that once students started promoting the correct answers, the teachers were excited. They think, hey, they got this. And then the teacher goes on to the next problem. And they might even do 10 or more problems in a single lesson. So I've really come to think about this this research here. This is from a series of Ginsberg studies, that the Singaporean students are expected to complete about one thorough lesson, a single topic per week in their pacing guides, while the US students are looking at one lesson on a narrowly focused topic per day almost. And that's a huge difference that's really stood out to me over the years. Sometimes I think a house like this, maybe on the beach, is kind of like propping up our mathematical model of education in a sense. I tend to think these support beams, for example, are propping up this house that's hopelessly hanging off the edge there. Maybe some of these support beams are like all the intervention that we offer. That other support beam right there, you see that one in the lower left? Like, that's test retakes. And there's one in the middle, kind of in the back over there, that's flexible grading. And that one up in the front, that's Saturday Academies. And we just have all these supports that are in place, but the real problem is we have a lousy location for our house. I think intuitively, we as teachers know this is a bad idea. And I just wonder why it persists. And maybe it's not just a matter of getting teachers into professional development and trying to make things stick more and trying to convince teachers of something that they don't, maybe that's inconsistent with their experience or something. And maybe we want to look more at the incentives and the environment in which that teachers have to work. And maybe I've come to wonder, what if we are underestimating the capabilities of teachers generally? What if we are just misassigning a low teacher performance, or so it appears as low teacher performance, or misassigning that performance to the teachers themselves, as opposed to the circumstances in which we work, into the system of our educational model that's really not doing what we expect or want it to do? It's this house on a beach, in other words. Phil Darrow also says that Japan gets excellent results from quite average teachers, but in the US, we often get average results from what are largely seen as some excellent teachers. And so that strikes me as being a surprising result. How we can get excellent results from average teachers in one country, but average results from excellent teachers maybe in another country. And so I wonder what's behind all this. So that led me into these four main sections for the presentation tonight. I'd like to share, my goal here tonight is to share some of these big ideas around these four topics with you. I would also really appreciate your own contributions to this webinar. I want this to be a two-way conversation. So I'd ask that you also share as the conversations come up, as the thoughts come to your mind. that you share them in the chat window, and I'll, like I said, discuss those later. So let's first start with student motivation and class culture. I will spend actually the most time of tonight's webinar in this section. It's the one I think I feel most passionately about, and that came through in how I was developing this presentation. So this is Chip Kelly. He's a former Philadelphia Eagles coach. He says that culture will beat scheme every day. So he's looking from a sports leadership perspective, from the coach-player relationship. And I think when I read this, I see similar dynamics as the teacher-student relationship. The impact of class culture for me in my own practice has been a huge revelation over the years. I didn't fully appreciate it until the past couple years, to be honest. I personally, I've just noticed it by myself, I tend to focus on the lesson plans, the nuts and bolts, improving that activity sheet. And this would be what Chip Kelly calls the scheme. And it's not to say that scheme isn't important, it is, but I think what Chip is saying in this case is that culture is more influential than scheme in those relationships that we have with students, in winning football games in his context. And I think in many ways, this quote applies to teaching as well. This is Jill Ellis. She's the coach of the U.S. Women's National Soccer Team. And she says this about building relationships. We have to have a trust there with the students, or in this case, our players. So when it's time that you are able to have those challenging conversations. And if we want, I've come to realize, if we want to get the most out of our students, we have to build those relationships first before any tough conversation has a chance at being successful. So there's a lot of supportive messages online from the sports world that I think connects very nicely with what we do in education. So these are three Twitter accounts. They tweet out a variety of these kinds of supportive motivational messages or inspirational quotations or quotes on leadership and others. And I love having this in my feed because it's a continuous reminder of, for me, some of the effective leadership and teaching practices as they come through and as they apply to other disciplines. And I think we have a lot to learn from these other disciplines. So these are a few quotations I've pulled. I have on my presentation website, I have an entire, I don't know, 15 pages or something of these quotations. It's shared in a Google Doc there for you. I also have some jokes that are shared there for you as well, if you like. But I pulled these sports quotes in particular on the screen here about failure and making mistakes. And these are just a few I know that these coaches or these athletes have mentioned over the years, but that really strike me as having a relevance to what we do in the classroom. So if I merely were to just tell students working hard will make up for a mistake that you make, it's not going to have the same effect on students, I think, as if they know a famous person or a celebrity, in this case, John Wooden, the third one down, says hustle makes up for many a mistake. It has an instant credibility when someone's won championships and I haven't, and they see me every day and they see this other celebrity on TV. So having it come from another source is more effective, I think, for students. And it also gives me an indirect way of developing class culture in a different way than just me trying to talk about it. So through those quotations document that I have on my webpage, you'll notice these kind of themes about motivation, about effort and practice, making mistakes, taking advantage of opportunities, leading to success. And so I'd encourage you to just search through the quotes that fit your needs and pull out some of your favorites. Spend 30 seconds in a class one day at the beginning of class or at the end of class, if you stop early or something, and talk about them. And just those 30 seconds with a quote or an image like I shared earlier can go a long way in building that classroom culture. It also helps set the norms and expectations that it'll stick with students because of how you presented it. There are also some connections between effective sports coaches and effective teachers. So we can think of teaching as a coach might in the sports world, I should say. And this one in red here really strikes me. If you see players who hate practice, their coach isn't doing a very good job, Bill Walsh. And this was a big ouch, I think, for me and for math teachers everywhere. If our students hate practice, their teacher isn't doing a very good job. Oh my, right? So I think we have a lot to learn about how we frame things, like a coach might frame practice, how they make practice more interesting for players. I mean, we can learn from that for our own practice. So let's shift gears a little bit here. Let's play a game. I'm gonna give you 20 seconds. The symbols on this screen stand for a well-known phrase. I'd like to give you 20 seconds to just see on your own if you can guess it. All right. What I came up with, and this is, I've seen this in a variety of places in math context and non-math context, is that less is more. And it fits mathematically, of course, but it's also a message that I'd like to delve into a bit more with you tonight. So one of the teaser questions, you may have seen it in the description of tonight's presentation, is what can Restaurant Impossible teach us about curriculum design? I'm sure you're wondering about this. So let's look at this question first. So there's one writer that says this about restaurant makeover shows in general. This is from a food blog online. Almost every show, these Restaurant Impossible and these other makeover shows, almost every show does it right by coming in and cutting the menu down drastically. The menus tend to collect more and more items as restaurant owners try to appeal to a larger audience or larger customers when the sales start to stall. They think that's the solution. You cannot be everything to everyone, and to try just dilutes your brand. And I saw this and it makes me think about whether math education has a similar problem. And maybe math education has a similar solution as the restaurant makeover shows. Maybe we're adding math standards into our curricula like a failing restaurant adds dishes to their menus. And this got me thinking. So there's some research from those other, this is a different Ginsburg study. The median coverage of the from the seven largest US states standards was 70% more topics covered per grade than in Singapore. This is in the seven largest states that were studied in this research. Florida, as a specific example, I think this is the most egregious state, covered 160% more topics per grade than Singapore. And the researchers noted that with so many more topics per grade, the US standards are just not able to expose students to the same depth of content as Singaporean standards, just because we're trying to do too much. We have too many standards. Similar citation from that research article. The United States covers all but 2% of the TIMSS topics through grade 8. So we cover virtually everything that's in TIMSS. This is compared to 25% non-coverage rate in the other countries. They cover only 75% of the standards. They omit 25%. Hong Kong, a high scoring Hong Kong's curriculum, omits 48% of TIMSS items through grade 4. That's just crazy to me. They don't cover 48% of the topics in the TIMSS assessment, and yet they score so strongly on that same assessment. 18% omission rate through grade 8. So this is hard data from these other countries that less topic coverage can still lead to higher scores on these topics because students are learning the mathematics better and they're learning to master the content that actually is taught. So now for the second teaser, as if that one wasn't enough, that like those stats really stick with me. Like this back here, like that really sticks with me. And so that leads into the second question. What can the dog whisperer teach us about class culture maybe? How does this fit into the less is more theme? If you're not familiar, in this show, Cesar Millan goes on house visits to people who have called in who have particularly hard to train and really unruly dogs. And he goes in to help the owners. It's really a show for the owners. People think it's about training the dogs, but it's really about training the owners as an alternative to euthanizing these animals. Cesar Millan keeps a pack of trained dogs at his training facility. And in one of the shows that I watch, he brings this one particularly unruly and difficult dog back to the training center and puts that dog into the large pack, the trained pack that he has at his facility. And it was surprising because the unruly dog very quickly assimilated and acquired the behaviors of the pack. And so it seemed like there was a tipping point that Cesar Millan is taking advantage of. This pack had, I don't know, like 15 dogs in it or something. And one particular unruly dog came in and just quickly assimilated to the pack. Although there's this tipping point where you could introduce too many unruly dogs and untrained dogs into the pack, and that would destabilize the pack. But introducing just one dog at a time resolved the dog's issues entirely. The dog just fit right in and picked up right where what the other dogs were doing in the pack. And that really stood out to me. And it got me thinking, of course, yet again about mathematics education. And it made me wonder, what if we taught fewer standards very well first? And only then did we methodically introduce an additional standard one at a time, maybe back into our curricula. This way, we might ensure that we don't overload our curriculum with too many standards and that that ultimately would derail our curriculum and our class culture. I think many teachers I talk to say there's just way too many standards. What if we just peeled it all back and did a few of those standards really well and then developed more and more standards when we were ready for it? Just like that one unruly dog assimilated into the well-behaved pack. So it stuck out to me and it reinforced for me the need to maintain the strength of the pack in bringing these new standards maybe into our courses, perhaps even if it means limiting how many standards that are initially placed into a course. So that less is more made sense in that context as well. This message also has connections in business, the well-known Apple ecosystem. Apple focused on being very good at only a few things, and it turned around the company to be one of the most successful companies in modern day history, of course. If you're not familiar with the story, Steve Jobs was famously fired from Apple, this company that he started himself. And then, of course, the company started doing poorly. And when he came back, the company asked them to come back, and he did. When he came back, he canceled 70% of Apple's products to really focus the company on making, at that time, one product really good. It was the iMac at the time. This was back in 1998. And they did really well with the iMac. They made it right. And they spent the time and they made it really good. And they attracted a following with that one product. And then, of course, it was the iPod in 2001. They made sure that the iPod talked nicely with the iMac and that ecosystem. They supported each other. And then it wasn't until 2006, 5 years later, that they came out with the MacBook. And then the iPhone in 2007. And all these devices talk well with each other. It was focused. And they did really well with one device at a time. They made sure that one device fit in with the rest of the ecosystem. Of course, it was the iPad in 2010. And now people come in, they get one device and they buy the rest of the device and they can't leave this ecosystem because it's all the devices talk and are so compatible with each other. Apple focused on doing the small number of things really well. And it makes me think that in math education, we need more of an Apple ecosystem. And I don't quite know what that looks like yet. I have some ideas, but just that idea really sticks to me that, you know, what if math education looked more like an Apple ecosystem? What would that look like? I do also think there's an equity component to all of this, to this less is more message. And I wonder if providing what in this US, will we provide equal access to, I think what's a largely a flawed model, this quick and snappy model, too many standards. Maybe this might actually exacerbate the achievement gap and cause inequities and unjust outcomes because we're not bringing students up as far maybe as they otherwise could. What if teaching fewer standards actually is the fence in this image here? What if actually teaching fewer standards, we could remove that barrier, that fence, so that all three on the far right, all three people can see the game without those supports or accommodations? Because the cause of the inequity, what perhaps is maybe too many standards and too quick and snappy of a curriculum, was we addressed that inequity. That was what the barrier was. A systematic barrier had been removed. So what if too fast pacing and the too shallow curricula is that fence maybe in this image? That is really sticky to me. Singapore has an alternative framework as an alternative to what we do in the United States. They recognize that some students may have more difficulty in mathematics, of course, but they actually provide an alternative framework. The United States frameworks don't. In Singapore, this alternative framework for lower performing students, they still cover all the mathematics topics in the regular framework, but they slow down. They focus. They have greater repetition. It's not diluting anything. It's at a slower pace. All the same mathematics still. We're not trying to quickly get every student doing all the same things, and that leads to a too quick and snappy curriculum. Singapore also provides its slower students with extra help from well-trained teachers. NCTM and then the states that they covered in this Ginsburg study did not provide such an alternative framework for the slower math students. So maybe there is something to this inequity argument, to that, to this image here on the previous slide. So let me pose this question. Do students or pacing guides dictate how you progress through your curriculum? And this has been one of the most frustrating parts for me at many different schools where I've taught. We have these pacing guides and we focus on collaborating well in teams and sharing those best practices. So maybe if I'm ineffective or slower in this one area, I work with my team and I can get faster and more effective in that area. And so this pacing guides kind of prompt some of those conversations to work well as a team. But it also, this is a tough one for me. It leads to some unintended consequences, I think, that are really tough for me to grapple with. I think it's hard to develop intrinsic motivation in students when it's the pacing guide dictating how students learn and how they progress through the curriculum. That intrinsic motivation is very difficult. I also suspect that the less is more would be welcomed by students. And perhaps it might create a more positive class culture, both for students and for teachers. I'll end this section with a reference to NCTM. This is their slogan, more and better mathematics for each and every student. And one of my teaser questions for this presentation and the description was, who can argue with that? And I said, I can, kinda. And the kinda is important, but I think I can. So based on my argument thus far for less is more, what if NCTM's slogan was less and better mathematics for each and every student? If you're convinced by the argument that I just laid out over the past 15 minutes or so, what's wrong with this then? Now, gasp, I put a gasp in there. I realize that this is not going to make for good PR, and I'm certainly not advocating that NCTM change their slogan in this way. But what if it was actually messaging-wise, and like enacting in the class, what if it was better for student learning outcomes? This less is more. So I realize that I may have just gotten myself in some trouble here. So let me be clear. I want to be crystal clear on this. Tremendous progress has been made in math education over the years. And that has led to higher success rates in more advanced math classes for more students. So I'm not advocating for a return to Algebra 1 as the highest math course or anything like that in high school. But I do wonder, between the more and the better components of this, I wonder whether we should be focusing more on the better before we start pursuing more. And perhaps then, and only then, if students are truly ready for more, well then let's introduce it to them by all means. But perhaps focusing on the better first might be a more worthwhile focus for us. So I started this section by discussing class culture and student motivation. And I wonder how might students respond differently in class if we did focus, in fact, on being excellent on fewer topics, like some of those other Singapore and Hong Kong and other countries in those studies, rather than trying to be average on the many different topics we try to cover. All right, let me have it. I'm ready for pushback. So tell me where I'm going wrong here. Let's head over to the chat window, please. And let's discuss this less is more segment. I'm very curious and eager to hear your thoughts. Love debate. Wow, there's a ton. I'm gonna have to get caught up on all this. How is that possible? I know. Shelly, you mentioned it definitely in Florida, the DOE is crazy about testing and getting as much possible during the year. It shows in the data. Is that 160% or whatnot? That was the most extreme state, I believe, in that study was Florida. Yes. Jackie, you make a good point here. I see it's a slippery slope, as some of my peers would slow down algebra to a crawl because of students' multiplication skills and would hammer them with math minutes. I think I know what you're referring to there. Definitely a concern. We would want to make sure that we have the systems in place, I think, like, you know, Hong Kong and some of these other countries do, about effective lesson study. And the teachers are still collaborating very well with each other to make sure that they are learning professionally together as well, and that they are engaging in those best practices. So many of the things I think that we know are good about professional practice, making sure we don't slow down to a crawl and not advance at all, but make sure that we are advancing in a high quality way on those slower topics. So that might address your concern there. Thank you very much for that. All right. Depends on the course. Yes, that's true. Yeah, I think it is going to depend. These outcomes and these what this looks like would vary with course for sure. I know with the common core standards, for example, more has been cut out of certain grade levels than others, and some topics in high school, some strands, I guess, in high school, Algebra 2 or whatnot, still has a ton in it. Yes. All right, great. Thank you all for the conversation. This is fantastic. All right, let's head into, thank you all for participating. I do want to make this meaningful for all of you, and I'm hope to do that through the chat window. So thank you all. That was much more than I expected, so thank you. Let's head into the second segment here, my favorite question. And what can blank teach us about math education? This is my favorite question to ask in a variety of contexts. So I'll give you an example. I saw a comedian once, and after the comedian gave their little spiel there, it was really good, actually. I went up and talked to him, and I asked, what can being a comedian teach me about being a more effective math teacher? And he was surprised by the question. I think that's probably one he doesn't get asked very often. And his response was that we should let students provide their own humor in class, and that we as teachers should actively solicit the humor from the audience, engage them as the audience, just as he does as a comedian. He tries to find those people in the audience and integrates humorous incidents or humorous people in the audience into his routine. It's not just a stand and deliver comedic routine either. I was also on an airplane once. I was talking to a guy next to me, and it turned out, I didn't realize at the time, he saw me grading and just we started talking about school. He was the superintendent of the fourth largest district in his state. And I didn't realize it until like halfway through the conversation when he mentioned this to me. He was just having a good old conversation with me, I think trying to learn from me probably about teaching. And he told me that. And then I turned and I wanted to learn from him. And so I asked him, what can being a superintendent in the fourth largest district in the state teach me about being a more effective math teacher in the classroom, at the classroom level? And he said that in his role, he is constantly trying to get to know the various stakeholders across the city, to understand the community leaders, the clergy, the public safety officials, parent groups, of course, and others, so that he as a superintendent can better balance and attend to all their various needs and concerns. And when things come up, it's a community, it's a collaborative effort in addressing them. And he suggested that teachers can do the same thing with our stakeholders at the classroom level. And I thought that was very important. One final example of this, I asked a Padres baseball player when I met him. You don't get to do that very often. He is a well-known player. If you know baseball, you would have heard of him. And I asked him the same question, what can being a baseball player teach me about math education? And he had nothing to say about this. His answer was not very coherent at all. But that's okay. It was worth asking, I think, just in case. But I did want to share that you're not always going to get a meaningful result, but I think it's worth asking for those moments when you do. And this question has led to very sticky stories. I remember them to this day, and I'm sharing them with you. It helps me to connect dots that I did not connect before, maybe about stakeholders and interest groups, and made those points in a more insightful way. If you're familiar with Robert Kaplinsky, he is very good with a powerful metaphor. He makes this point, he just blogged recently about this, maybe a month or two ago. He saw this sign, on, presumably on the back of a hotel room door, and he asked, what can fire evacuation maps teach us about math education? The same question I had before, over many years, he's asking it about this fire map. And it led him to this message for professional development providers. He says, and this is a quote, I believe that as professional development providers, we should aim for more fire drills and less fire maps. We should actively rehearse for the fires and practice and leave the building along these routes and do less of here's a map, here's what you should do, just know what to do in the event of emergency. And this has obvious connections, of course, in the classroom, that we need to engage students and teachers for that matter in the learning that we seek from them, and not just hand them a worksheet or something and expect them to know what to do with that. Another analogy from Robert, he talks about steak. He tells a story about how he took a cooking class, and one of the lessons from this cooking class was that you can't uncook a steak. So to be cautious and test it frequently so that when it does get to the intended degree of doneness, you don't have an issue with trying to take it back because you can't. And Robert made this connection to teaching and learning about math education. He He says it's better to under question. And if the student still isn't there, you can always ask a follow-up question. But if we pose a too helpful question that does too much of the thinking for the students, we spoil the punchline for students' learning. And so it's easy to be, we want to avoid asking that too helpful question. It's better to err on the side of caution and under question because we can always cook it some more, so to speak. And that had meaning for me. I think about this steak metaphor frequently as I'm questioning students. Don't pose that too helpful of a question right away. I can always ask a follow-up. So aside from sharing sticky ideas, I wanted to make the point that there are lessons about education all around us, and we just have to look for them. And that's why I really like this question about what can blank teach me about math education. It helps me form new metaphors that help make these lessons about math education more sticky in my mind or more memorable, certainly. The next one here, I'd like to pose a similar question. If we know so well what works with student learning in the classroom, shouldn't those same lessons work with teacher learning at professional conferences and professional development? So I saw this on Twitter half a year ago or several months ago, at least. This is an example. Someone posted this on Twitter. I blocked out the name. But someone posted this, and at first I saw this, I was like, wow, look at all those ribbons. But I then quickly wondered, like, what's the point? Like, what is this? And it made me wonder what somebody who feels the need to put all these ribbons on, like, what are they trying to project about themselves to others at the conference? Okay, now, maybe this is just a collection and someone was having fun with it. But there certainly are other people I've seen where that's not the intent. And they have 3, 4, 5, 6 ribbons and they wear it proudly. And it got me thinking, what's the point? So I actually blogged about this. I did some photo editing there and I made this badge on the right with just one single digitally edited badge. I would just say learning. And so I blogged about this. I'd encourage you if you want to go read about more about it, what I wrote. This is also linked on my presentation page. And I asked, I think, what's a fairly uncomfortable question, which was, why are we okay giving and using labels through these ribbons at our conferences? We label committee members who plan the committee. We label speakers because they were accepted and have some authority or some special knowledge to share with everybody. Why are we okay with labels for each other at our conferences? But rightly, we resist providing these labels, certainly in a public way, to students in the classroom. So even though many ribbons are innocuous and they're well-intended, for example, you see several on the left there, I heart CMC is not a sign of status or authority or anything, but some ribbons are. And so I pose that uncomfortable question. We would never publicly label higher achieving students in class. We would never put a badge on them that says has an A in class or taking 5 AP classes. And so I ask, why label speakers with a speaker badge or committee members with a committee badge? Why bother having speakers wear their badge, wear their ribbon rather, throughout the entire conference rather than just during the presentation while they're speaking? And it just raised these questions for me. It got my ideas flowing. What if we just did give everybody at the conference, speakers, committee members, regular attendees, just a single badge that says, I'm here to learn? And there was a robust discussion that ensued online. You can, it's linked in the blog. You can read that there. But there's a variety of agreements and disagreements, but that debate, I think, was meaningful for me. At minimum, and I'm sharing this with you here also, I think it's worth thinking about why do we wear ribbons? And then maybe get you thinking about your own thoughts on this when you see this picture, what thoughts come to mind. All right, I'm going to skip ahead to the third segment here. I'm going to ask some poll questions here for you. This is from my love-hate relationship with grading. This is a tough one for me. I've grappled with the grading question for a long time now. So I'm going to post a few polls here. So here's the first one. If inflating grades increases student motivation and encouragement to work harder, and then subsequently students demonstrably learn more than if we hadn't inflated the grades, like we're able to identify that those inflated grades had that motivational impact, for example, was inflating grades worth it? So artificially, we gave students higher grades. We, you know, the students that are borderline C, we bumped them up to a B and they got more interested in math. Maybe they weren't disciplined or their parents weren't on their case as much at home now they had to be. Was inflating the grades worth it, even given that it demonstrably led to more student learning. Look at the split in this. I love it. It's about 55-45, it looks like. 53-47. That is fascinating to me, just how split we are. This has been my experience here as well. All right, second question. Let me pose a second question. Thank you, everybody. That is very good to know. Second question. All right, if we were to inflate grades to the extent that fairly large numbers of students complete our current course, like we got them through, they got passing grades, they met the prerequisite for the next course, whatever that prerequisite was, but when they make it to the next course, they are not succeeding in those courses. Was grade inflation worth it? All right, this one is definitely more one-sided. You have one indifferent in there, it looks like, and then probably not a few and definitely not worth it. I think I tend to agree. This maybe the way I phrased the question was led it even more in that direction. But it got me thinking, like, maybe to what extent is this actually happening? That we're pushing students along with higher inflated grades and then they're not successful in the next course because of they weren't fundamentally prepared. I think there's probably a lot of agreement around that issue. All right, and then the third one. This is the third and final poll question here. If inflating grades leads to more high school graduation and college admissions, but students are not prepared for success in that first year of college and then they drop out, was grade inflation worth it, at least for getting students farther along than they otherwise would have gone? All right. Yeah, we have a couple in there, probably worth it. This one is a little more, I'm a little more on the fence actually about this one. And we kind of see that in the results here as well. Thank you all. Because I think it's hard to, what sticks with me when I've thought about this, it's hard to know who's going to be successful in college and who's not. Who's a late bloomer maybe? They just haven't found their passion. And they get to college, they realize that there's more to life beyond high school and there's more opportunities available. They can take a wider variety of classes maybe, and then they find their passion. If we didn't get them to that college admissions, perhaps they never would have found that passion of theirs, or maybe it would have taken longer to come around to it. So this one, I think there's a little more nuance in there, but it does still impact this grade inflation debate. All right, thank you all very much for that. All right, so talking about grade inflation here, there's a great story from the Ford company. This is back in the 2006, 2007, 2008 time. During this time, it's pre-2008 recession, of course. The U.S. automakers were losing market share to other companies internationally. And these companies in Michigan were deeply unprepared for what was the imminent financial crash that no one saw coming in 2008, of course. And I shared this link. It's on the presentation website, on my website. But I'll just summarize the story like this. When Alan Mulally arrived in 2006 at the Ford company as CEO, there was a culture there that no one dared admit that anything was wrong. They're sitting in the meetings and each division head was reporting, we are right on track and we're having high performance from all of our employees. And yet, in the role of CEO, for example, he sees that the Ford company is losing market share. And certainly before the 2008 crash, the bottom fell out. So he sees a discrepancy between what these division heads are reporting this meeting, and there's this fear of admitting that anything was wrong. So at one of these meetings, there was the head of the Ford's Americas division, whoever that was, had some bad news. And he shared that there was a problem with one of the hydraulic parts, and this part would force a delay of the launch of this new SUV for a couple of weeks. And Mulally recalls that the room got deathly quiet. And in that moment, Alan Mulally started clapping. And he says it was a defining moment for the company. Just that small gesture in a very tense moment signaled an enormous change for the company. And he says almost immediately, other executives across divisions felt free to admit that they too had problems. They were honest about the problems and they started working together to resolve them. And they started developing better cars and better products, and they were focused on the right things. And as a result, famously, the company returned to profitability without receiving bailout money from the federal government, like a couple other United States car manufacturers had to take those bailouts. And when I read this article, my mind jumped to great inflation. I think the underlying learning process, in some more or less ways, but in this underlying process, is largely broken in some cases. A great inflation, when we feel the need to prop up our numbers and have lower the failure rates and get students through, masks the problem in ways that are very similar to this Ford Motor Company. We have fewer students as a result pursuing STEM majors. We have lower college completion rates. And teachers and administrators even are unwilling and disincentivized in many cases to acknowledge that there's a problem. And so this really stood out to me. We need someone, we need a principal, we need a superintendent, we need a leader, a national leader, to start clapping in that tense moment and to really be honest and transparent about our challenges and our problems, especially with, in this case, great inflation, and to help address the problem in a more meaningful and more effective way. All right, I wanted to stop here and get some more pushback from you. I am almost out of time, I realize. This last section is short, and then I'd love to check out the chat window at the very end of this, and I will have some more discussion. So the last segment is critical thinking is for teachers too. Just a couple slides here. I'd like to make this argument that critical thinking is also for teachers. Now, if you're familiar with critical thinking, or if you're not, that's okay. A working definition, we had some professional development in my district recently. I took a critical thinking course in college, which is by far the best course I've ever taken in my life. Critical thinking has been very instructive and informative for me in thinking about my own practice. And this image, I think, captures it. So there's this guy thinking about a puzzle piece he's holding up, and how does that puzzle piece fit into all the other puzzle pieces that he has in his mind? So a working definition of critical thinking is a process. It's of making informed conclusions through evaluating evidence and assumptions. And this is generalizable across many disciplines, not just mathematics, but making informed conclusions through evaluation of evidence and stated assumptions, because we don't always have perfect evidence, of course. And I feel like this image is really a powerful one to have in mind. And I'd like to share that with you with critical thinking from a teaching perspective. Another way I think about critical thinking is as skeptical thinking, critical as skeptical. Having a skepticism about when students have truly learned something. One correct answer from a student is never enough. There's this skeptical line of thinking, this doubt line of thinking from Clarence Darrow. Just think of the tragedy of teaching children not to doubt. We want children to doubt things and be skeptical and make sense of the world for themselves and come to their own conclusions about things. And I would propose that we do the same thing as teachers with the evidence that we see from students about their learning. One correct answer from a student should never be enough. In that Japanese example, once students start proposing the ideas, we as teachers shouldn't go on to the next problem and think, hey, they got it. The Japanese teachers stay on that problem for 15 minutes or longer, looking at the various forms, and that learning continues to deepen as a result. I'm a sports guy. I'm a golf nut. There's a saying in golf that amateurs practice until they get it right, and pros practice until they can't get it wrong. So very similar to what we just discussed, hitting one good shot in the driving range certainly doesn't mean I can replicate that good shot on the course. It's better to be skeptical and say, that one good shot I hit, was it really because I made a good adjustment in my swing, or was it just a random timing issue? Well, I can keep practicing and find out pretty easily. But it's better to be skeptical when you see one good shot, for example, and not just jump to the conclusion that I've truly improved my golf game as a result of seeing that one good shot. Because in my own experience on the golf course, that's definitely not the case. I'm in the water on the next shot and my arrogance got to my head and I paid the price. So it should be no surprise that the skepticism has a precedent in mathematics also. It's statistics. we require a certain level of confidence, right? We require this confidence before we reject a null hypothesis and we accept a conclusion as a result of that evidence that we've seen. This picture stands out to me. Will you marry me? And I fail to reject the null hypothesis. And the guy's like, crap. Failing to reject the null hypothesis, that's no change. That's students not knowing it yet. That's our null hypothesis. At what point do we reject that null hypothesis and conclude that the student truly knows it? And my call to action through this metaphor, through this connection here, is to lower your p-value. Lower the probability that we're wrong in rejecting that null hypothesis. We wrongly conclude that students have learned something well when actually they have not. That's lowering your p-value. We understand this in mathematics as mathematicians, and yet I find myself in the classroom saying, great, they got it. We want to be optimistic about our students' learning, right? We want to think like, yes, and we want to project that optimism in class to be encouraging to students. But we have to be able to lower that p-value and demand a higher standard of evidence before we just conclude that students truly and deeply have understood the content. All right, at this point, I would love to get your feedback. I'm going to head over to the chat myself. Let's see what the comments are. Give me some pushback. Tell me where I'm going wrong on all of this. I'd love to hear your thoughts, everybody. All right, interactive process, Dana, yes. Yeah, Lee, you make a great point. I think many of us can say the same thing about our own PD. So much PD is... I'm out here locally in the San Diego area, the CMC South, as well as some other conferences that are trying to design conferences to allow for some of that downtime, that on-conference model, for example. Have that time to digest and give some of that flex time. We did that with the Greater San Diego Math Council that I'm a part of and very proud of. So yes, that's a great point, I think. Yeah, Daniela makes a point. I see in your comment, Daniela, thank you. You're making an assumption that students will learn more. Without a doubt, we want to make sure that students are actually learning more, no doubt about it. We want to make sure we are in touch with students and have valid measures, valid assessments to understand that they truly are learning what we intend for them to learn. So no doubt about that, that is always still has to be in the forefront, absolutely. Deb, you make a great comment. I've seen this from many parents also. The parents just want to see the grade and not what the students have learned. Yep. That's a challenge that we all grapple with, I think. Certainly when it comes to, I'm a high school teacher, upper level teacher at that. Certainly when it comes to, there's the pressure on admissions and scholarships and college admissions and everything. There's a previous comment about seeing the name of the college. No doubt about it. Grappling with parents from a motivational side is challenging here as well. All right, great. Thank you, everybody. This is fantastic conversation. Yeah. Okay, great. So that's all I got. The closure here that I had planned. I guess I'll ask you if you want to stick around for another 1, 2, 3 minutes. I'm happy to take questions here as well. In the chat window, if you would, if you want to respond to one or both of these two questions. I'll just preface your response with a Q1 or a Q2, if you would. Q1 being, what's a sticky idea that you have, you wish everyone else knew? And then Q2, what questions do you have for me? And I'm happy to try to answer those for a few minutes. Again, if you have to leave, thank you very much. I'm honored that you chose to spend your evening with me. And then I'm happy to stay on, like I said, for the discussion if you want to stick around for these questions and that you have for me.
So I want to say thank you to Jason while you're all answering your Q1 and Q2. Again, if you want to watch tonight's presentation, that chat window was really going as he was talking. And if you want to come back and have time to process and let things stick, I would encourage you after a couple of hours to come back and look at the recording. I would also encourage you to share this with people that you work with and let them come. And I think this is a great, many of these topics that he brought up tonight are great discussion starters for lunch table and department meetings and all of those good sorts of things to help push on people's thinking. So thanks, Jason. That was awesome.
Fantastic. Thanks. I see Daniela, you asked for a list of questions. I'm not sure what that's referring to.
Oh, maybe the two questions that you had. Yeah.
Yep. Oh, the last, the closure slide. Sure. I'll do it this way so I can still monitor the chat. Can you see that screen, everybody? Yep. Okay. And by all means, attendees here, if you're still on, you're welcome to unmute your microphone if you want to verbalize rather than chatting back and forth through text here. As long as we just all don't talk over each other all at the same time, that's fine. But by all means, unmute and ask a question.
They'll have to ask for permission because they don't have control to unmute their own.
Oh, I didn't realize that. Okay.
I can if they would like to be unmuted.
I see Paula just shared Q1 here. An idea that stuck with her is that everyone needs to know that learning is ongoing, even for teachers. If you're familiar with Randy Phillip, he's local here in San Diego. He's also the president of AMTE, I believe it is. He makes a great point. He talked that he gave the closing session at a GSDMC conference about a little over a year ago. And he thanked everyone in his closing session. He thanked the teachers who were toward the end of their career, right? The teachers who had maybe like 25 plus years of experience or something, and they're still attending conferences. Even at the end of their career, they still have this passion for learning and professional growth, even though they're toward the end of the career. And credit, of course, to the principals for supporting that growth. It could very easily say, look, we need to devote these resources to the younger teachers or something, or middle career teachers who are gonna be with the district longer. But it really speaks volumes, I think, to that concept of learning is ongoing, even for teachers and even late in their career. Thank you, Paula, for that. Dana, less is more is a subject I'm passionate about, and I share my thoughts every chance I can. Yeah, you go. I'll be right there with you.
Hey, Jason, one of the questions that came up was how to get people to listen to some of these ideas. And I know like your involvement with CMC. So, I think for those of us who are totally on board with you, it sometimes is a frustration. So in terms of, you know, how do you think we get people to listen to this?
Yeah, no doubt that's a challenge. I have never been part of a math department that didn't have that challenge. I'm sure many of us can share the same experience. I think, you know, when you first posed that question, the one thing that came to my mind is some of those sports quotes at the very beginning that I shared, is that if we're gonna have challenging conversations, we can't have those conversations first, and we can't challenge other teachers' practice, for example, around some of these ideas, until we've really developed those relationships in the first place. And we have to have that culture among your colleagues and at the school and with your administrators as well. So maybe that's probably might be my first answer, is that we can't get someone to listen if the culture and environment isn't there to facilitate that learning growth and that openness to these ideas either. All right, Jennifer, I see you can't be passionate and effective about teaching if you're not passionate about that learning as well. Absolutely. Students see it too. I mean, they see right through you if you're kind of artificial about your passion, or you try to fake excitement about something. They see right through that. I think it's important to be genuine and being passionate about learning. It's kind of inevitable that that's going to come through. If you're excited about the learning and excited about what you're doing, you don't have to think about it maybe. Oh, great comment. Thank you. Dana, where can we find the sports quotes? On my presentation website, if you go to slowbee.weebly.com, and then there's a link for, it's a Google Doc that has a ton of way too many pages. I stopped updating it after a while. It was very time consuming. I just started liking all the comments on Twitter. But yeah, that document is there. And then if you follow those accounts, of course, you'll get some of your own. Thanks, Paula, for posting it. All right. Well, I guess at this point also, I'd encourage you to, if you want to continue this conversation offline, I'm going to put my contact information or title slide, I guess, back up here. So I'm happy to continue the conversation on Twitter or by email or any other form. If you're going to be in DC for the NCTM annual, I'd be honored if you kind of let me know. Maybe we can, if you see each other in passing or something, let me know. Otherwise, thank you very much.
Thank you, everyone. Thanks, Jason.
Thanks, Paula.